May it please the Court, Michael Barry, Benish Friedlander, Copeland and Aronoff on behalf of the appellant, Brantley Management Corporate Company. Your Honor, yesterday at 3:45, we received a letter from the clerk of the court asking us to be prepared to discuss the effect of the dissolution of Brantley Management Company on this appeal. We are prepared to dispense with that. If the court prefers, we can do that right now. We had learned back in October or November of last year, Brantley Management Company was dissolved under Section 271 of the Delaware General Corporation Law. Litigation that is commenced before dissolution or within 3 years after dissolution continues and shall not abate, and the corporation shall continue in existence until the final judgment or execution thereon is done in that case. And that goes for any proceeding, suit, or action pending at the time. This certainly is a proceeding before this court. So the corporation does continue in existence for the sole purpose of continuing any existing litigation, any litigation commenced within 3 years from the dissolution date, as well as for the purpose of winding up its affairs. Obviously, liquidation of the claim of Mr. Saltz versus Brantley Management Company is part of the winding up as well. So that corporation will continue to exist until those things are done for at least 3 years.
There was a judgment entered against the corporation before it was dissolved?
The judgment was entered for the corporation in May.
Before it was dissolved?
The company was dissolved, then judgment was entered.
And I gather your position is that the dissolution has no impact on that judgment.
The dissolution has no impact on that judgment. There is a case not by the Supreme Court.
There may be at most a collection problem.
At most a collection issue, yes. With respect to the opinion entered by the lower court, the appellant believes that there are three reversible errors that are on appeal. Number one was the lower court determined a factual dispute in the movement's favor, a dispute that was clearly raised in argument and clearly contained in the record. And that dispute was whether or not there was consideration, specifically who asked for a promissory note to be amended. The second issue on appeal is whether an amendment to a promissory note can constitute a negotiable instrument so that that document can be given for an antecedent debt, which would then permit there to be consideration to be deemed valid under the Uniform Commercial Code. And the third error that the lower court had made was whether or not a condition precedent had been waived. With respect to the contentions, with respect to the facts below, real simple, are in 2004, a note was executed.
With regard to your first contention that the trial court determined a factual dispute in movement's favor, I note you left out the word material.
Your Honor, that was the materiality, it clearly was material. That is the entire crux of the case. That fact goes to whether or not Mr. Saltz prevails or whether or not Brantley Management Company prevails. If, in fact, Mr. Saltz had asked for that amendment, and there's record evidence to support that he did, specifically being there was an investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission that Mr. Saltz wanted to disassociate himself from, and there was the fact that Mr. Saltz was an insider of the biggest revenue stream of Brantley Capital, so he knew that there was not going to be a revenue stream to pay the note. Those two things prompted him to ask for the amendment. So Mr. Saltz wanted that amendment. That amendment was executed by Brantley Management Company.
So that goes to his motivation, correct?
Well, it goes to the motivation, and it also goes to the fact that that's the consideration. I mean, the consideration was he wanted a revenue stream to pay his note. He wanted to disassociate himself from the SEC investigation. In order to do that, he had to transfer the note or ask for it to be transferred from Brantley Capital to Brantley Management. That is the consideration. The motive to ask for it here happens to be the same as the consideration itself. Obviously, if the corollary of that also cuts against this case, Mr. Saltz contends that he gave up a right. He gave up a right, but because he couldn't chase Brantley Capital. Well, if he asked for it, then that cuts against this case, because why would you ask for something to give something up?
Well, is there any dispute that there was a forbearance?
Yes, there is a dispute that there was a forbearance. The dispute that there was a forbearance is that...
Is that a legal question?
Whether or not, no, yes and no. Whether there was a forbearance or not would be a legal question, but whether there was, whether the forbearance was bargained for is a question for a trier of fact, and this is a jury trial. So a trier of fact would have to make the determination that, well, in 2006, was there a bargain for exchange? What was Mr. Saltz looking for? Was Brantley Management looking for something? And if a trier of fact finds that, well, Brantley Management wanted the note to be changed and there was a forbearance because he gave up that legal
let's
right.
Let's cut through this and approach it from a different angle. You say there's a dispute as to who requested the amendment of the note.
Correct.
And on that, and that's a material dispute?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if it is material, isn't it material only to the issue of who got the benefit?
It's material as to who got the benefit or who gave a detriment.
Why?
Why? Well, because consideration is also giving up a legal detriment. So if...
That's right. And why would it be relevant to that? That is, I can understand, you know, as a matter of common sense, that the person who asked for the amendment might be doing that to get a benefit.
That's exactly the point, yes.
If there's a detriment that's involved, then you've got consideration irrespective of who asked.
That is correct, as long as that detriment is bargained for at the time the amendment was executed. So if it was never contemplated by the parties at the time of the execution of the amendment, then there is no detriment that formed any consideration. If the event happened to be post hoc, if Mr. Saltz decided to sue BMC, Brantley Management, instead of Brantley Capital, post hoc, after that note was executed, just because that's who he wanted to sue, that's not a legal detriment that formed consideration back in 2006.
If there's a legal detriment, why does it have to be bargained for? What's the authority for that proposition?
The authority for that proposition is every single contract case that we examined, that all consideration has to be bargained for at the time of a contract. It has to be bargained for exchange. You either have to, the promisee has to give something up in exchange for the promise, or the promisor has to get a benefit for in exchange for the promise. And that has to be done.
One can infer. Simply from the way this transaction occurred, the detriment was bargained for. So unless there's some controverting evidence in the record that it wasn't bargained for, that it was somehow, it just appeared out of nowhere, why is there a material fact dispute?
The material fact dispute is because there was no forbearance. There was no detriment. There was nothing given up. The record is clear that Mr. Saltz never made any point in the record to say, I gave up my rights against Brantley Capital. He never said that. He said he had never pursued him. I never sued that person or that entity. There was never a relinquishment of a known right. There was never, the amendment never provided waiver language. There was nothing expressed on the record, nothing implied in the transaction that Brantley Capital was off the hook. What they were trying to do at the time of the amendment was just substitute the obligor under the note.
Well, if you look at the Superior Court opinion, they address the issues that you've been talking about and some other issues. Then at the end of the opinion, the Superior Court seems to be influenced by the fact that Brantley Management paid almost $400,000 in interest on a debt it now says it had nothing to do with. And the Superior Court said, you know, that just doesn't make sense.
Logically, there is some appeal to that argument. However, a contract that is formed or fails to be formed for lack of consideration is a void contract. It is not fixable. The contract ceases, does not exist. You can't ratify, you can't waive, you can't waive yourself into a contract. If it fails for consideration, the contract is void, period. You can't ratify that. You can't perform under it and then have that somehow form estoppel arguments later on. It is void.
So does Brantley Management want all of its interest back?
Brantley Management has not asked for its interest back. I don't know if Brantley Management would request that it be paid back or not. I somehow doubt that would happen.
since they're under common control of the same person.
They're
really going from one pocket to the other.
Yes and no, Your Honor. Brantley Management is owned 100% by Mr. Pincus. Brantley Capital was not owned 100% by Mr. Pincus. That was owned 70% by Mr. Pincus.
So?
So he was the managing member, and he did have control over both entities. But the fact is that this is no different than a gratuitous payment. You had a very good friend.
It's different from a gratuitous payment, given that there is a common controller.
Your Honor, I disagree with that, because then all of a sudden we're now going to look past corporate existences because one person happens to be the person in charge of those companies. They're still corporations.
Why not? Why can't we look past corporate existence and recognize the reality?
Because there is no veil-piercing theory in this case that was dismissed.
Veil-piercing may come into play if there comes a time when the plaintiff here wants to collect on a judgment against the corporation, Brantley Management, and it has no assets. Then it may have to go into a court of equity to pierce a corporate veil. But here, what principle would preclude this court from looking at the reality of common control for purposes of determining whether there was a proper legal remedy granted?
Because at that point, you're looking past the contract that was entered into or attempted to be entered into by parties with counsel.
As I understand the record, Mr. Salt sent $1 million to what I'll call an investment company, an investment advisor, and then, as it turned out, he got a note from Brantley Capital that says Brantley Capital is going to owe you $1 million.
Correct.
So it looks like he sent in $1 million, and then it was invested with Brantley Capital. However, the record also seems to indicate that interest all along was paid by Brantley Management.
With the exception of very few payments, most of the interest payments were made by Brantley Management. Brantley Management had been making the payments even before that note was executed. So therefore, even, that waiver argument still fails, because if you're doing it before, then what kind of additional consideration was there when the note was executed to do it afterwards?
Well, doesn't the record also reflect that Mr. Pincus signed a $1 million note to Brantley Management when this was redone?
No, that note was signed a few years later. It wasn't signed as part of the transaction, and nor was that bargained for.
It was part of the
as part of the transaction.
Well, I guess the record says we have to clean up what we've been doing here, and as part of the cleanup, the paper trail, so to speak, Mr. Pincus executed a note. Is that right?
That is correct. However, that note that was executed years after the 2006 transaction occurred was not part of the basis of the transaction in 2006. There was no bargain for exchange, and I know that the
court... Well, we don't know that. We just know there was no documentation. Isn't that correct?
You know that there was no documentation.
Cleaning up.
That's right.
There was some cleaning up that was needed because there was no documentation of these elements of a contract that you claim now don't exist, or at least that there's a factual dispute about. So it appears, and I'm phrasing this as a statement, but it's really a question, that Mr. Saltz is trying to take advantage of the fact that he was operating in a loosey-goosey fashion without, getting some of these dots, I's dotted and T's crossed, when he could have done that earlier.
Again, Your Honor, I understand exactly what you're saying and the implications of how that appears. However, what has to be looked at and what a jury should have decided in this case is whether that was the bargain for exchange. Did Brantley Management go into that transaction thinking that it was going to receive those benefits?
Well, don't we have to conclude from your position that that Brantley Management ended up paying $400,000 plus interest, I guess, for nothing?
Yes. Yes, you do. But you have to also realize that the record shows that these two gentlemen, the principal of Brantley Management and Mr. Saltz, were very good friends for many years.
Were what?
Very good friends for many, many years. These guys were the best of friends. So they jogged together weekly. They had houses near each other. They're both sophisticated businessmen. So Mr. Pincus and Brantley Management Company did go out of their way to make sure Mr. Saltz was being paid. When the investment failed and everybody lost their money, however, people looked into the agreements and saw that these were the issues. But if this can also be equated to you're driving your car, somebody throws a rock off the top of a bridge, it breaks your glass and injures you. Somebody says to you, I feel bad about that, let me pay you $100 a week for the rest of my life until I die. You pay the $100 a week for the rest of your life till you die. You could stop that at any time. There's no contract there. It's a gratuitous payment. It doesn't have appeal. I understand it, but that's the law. At this time, I see I'm running down. I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal if I'm permitted.
Very well.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Joseph Ballou from Cozen and O'Connor on behalf of the appellee, the plaintiff below, Peter Saltz. Your Honor, you hit on the point whether this was a material issue of fact, and we submit that it was not a material issue of fact. If you review the transcript at the motion to compel, the joint motions to compel, the trial court asked us, you know, for purposes of summary judgment, does it really matter who requested the amendment? And we said it does not, because it's not material to the issue.
And why not?
Because the amendment occurred, Your Honor. It isn't a situation where someone's now maintaining we never requested the amendment or you never requested the amendment. We know the amendment took place. This isn't a situation where one person said the light was green and the other person said the light was red and therefore there's a material issue of fact. We know that this amendment occurred.
Well, and the amendment occurred in part, as pointed out, Brantley Capital never signed. There was no release, indemnification, substitution. It seems either informal or incomplete.
Well, Your Honor, it was very formal because the note was executed. The promissory note was executed by Brantley Capital and Mr. Saltz, and then the amendment was signed by Brantley Management and Mr. Saltz. So the borrower.
Well, what happened to Brantley Capital in the
Brantley amendment? Capital. His obligations were relieved once the amendment was signed.
And where do we read that in the record?
Well, we read that in the record, Your Honor, as the trial court indicated. A sophisticated business entity does not continue to pay under a note for 4 years if it doesn't have an obligation. All the parties acted in conformity with that. And, you know, they talk about a gratuitous promise. This was not a gratuitous promise. They knew that this
would. I'm not disparaging your argument in any way. I simply want you to acknowledge that your argument doesn't find support in writings. It really finds support in a course of conduct because the writings are incomplete.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the writings are incomplete insofar as you substitute BMC for BCC and the payments continue. So
that's a course of conduct, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, it's not a course of conduct insofar. I could see if it was a course of conduct if the note was never amended and one day Mr. Saltz had come to Mr. Pincus had come to Mr. Saltz and said, we're now going to pay the interest. But there was a document that was signed that shows that the individual now responsible for making those payments is BCM. So it has been documented. And they maintain that that's important because whether or not there was consideration or if there was who requested it. But there was consideration here. Both parties.
Are you arguing that there's no material issue of fact? Because regardless of who benefited, there was a detriment here?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, and what was the detriment?
There's a detriment to my guy, Mr. Saltz, in that he was now no longer looking to BCC to make payments on the note because when the amendment was signed, it said that payments now would be made by BMC, Brantley Management Capital. So we gave up the right. He didn't look to.
Do you realize that the course of conduct question supports your argument?
Correct, Your Honor.
You seem to be suggesting that the course of conduct was relevant out of hand, and I'm encouraging you not to do that.
Okay, Your Honor. Okay. There was not a material issue of fact that needs to be resolved. If you review the transcript where that colloquy goes back and forth, the position was, does it really matter? And the conclusion was, it doesn't matter. Then we move on to the
consent. The other side says it was a gratuitous promise. You say it wasn't a gratuitous promise. Why isn't that a dispute of fact?
Because they signed the note. BMC signed the note indicating that they would now be responsible for the payments. It wasn't like, oh, that guy's destitute. I'll pay you because he's...
Why would they want to do that? What did they get in return?
Okay, this is what they got in return, Your Honor. If you look at the terms and conditions of the amended note, not only did they get credit, they were going to be responsible for paying the interest going forward, but it says that they were getting credit for the payments already made. Okay, it says that...
So they got a tax deduction.
Right, they got the tax deduction. Not only that, they got credits for the monies that were already paid, and it says... All payments made to Mr. Saltz under this note and subsequent to. So for the first 2 years where it was supposed to be BCC paying, if it's just truing up the paperwork, we know they get a benefit now because they're getting the benefit of the 2 years payments, even though it may have not have been officially on the books that way, it is now. Okay, and there's a further benefit.
So, and this goes back to what we were talking about in the record, that although Brantley Capital was supposed to pay the interest from the beginning, in fact, Brantley Management had been paying the interest. So the execution of this amendment ratifies what had been taking place.
It's a true reflection of what had been taking place. And so there's a benefit to BCC. They no longer have to pay the interest.
Yes, one, let me interrupt you for a moment. Your honorable opposing counsel says, yeah, even if that's true, those benefits have to be bargained for, and there's no evidence in the record that this was bargained for. And for all we know, Mr. Saltz could have the right to proceed against BCC as well as BMC. Didn't get that right up.
No, he didn't, but there was bargained for, Your Honor, insofar as he relinquished the right to go after BCC.
Where is the evidence that he relinquished the right to go after BCC?
Because if you read the terms of the note, it substitutes BMC for BCC.
Does it say substitutes?
Your Honor, it says that all payments, the name of the borrower shall be changed to Brantley Management Company. So once that was executed, the borrower is no longer BCC, it's BCM. So there is a bargain for exchange here because they're changing the name of the borrower. And they executed it in the capacity Mr. Pincus executed as the CEO of Brantley Management Company, and it clearly says borrower. And Mr. Saltz was the lender. So there was a bargain for
it. You could read that language to say that Brantley Management was being substituted, but it is somewhat baroquely worded.
Well, Your Honor, I agree with you that you know, looking back in hindsight, everyone can come back and say, well, this is what our true intention was, or maybe it was inartfully drafted, but this was presented to my client by the chief financial officer of Brantley Management Company. This is what they presented to him, and they said, and the record reflects that we want to true up the paperwork here, so we need to amend this note. And it was signed, and more importantly, he continued to pay it for 4 years.
Are you saying, going back to my earlier question, where Mr. Saltz sends in $1 million to an investment company, and he's told, your $1 million is going to Brantley Capital, that later we find out, for all intents and purposes, it went to Brantley Management. And so if everything would have been done at the beginning, the way it turned out in reality, it would have been Brantley Management all along.
Correct, Your Honor, but that's not what my client was led to believe. The note indicates that the first promise...
I understand that.
Right, then it goes back and it's all along. Just, well, this is the way we've been doing things because BCC really doesn't have a revenue stream. The money is actually coming from BCN. So at that point in time, my client accepts the amendment, signs the amendment, and now it's reflected that he's being paid by BMC. And there's a detriment and benefit to both parties.
Going back to what we're trying to imply or reconstruct from the record, your client was basically saying, look, I sent you $1 million. I wanted to get 10%. You told me I was going to get it from Brantley Capital. You now tell me I'm getting it from Brantley Management. Fine with me. I just want my 10%.
Correct. Someone else is honoring the note. One of your companies is now honoring the same terms and conditions of the note, and we've memorialized that by changing the name of the borrower from BCC to BCM. And it continues in that way. So there is not a material issue of the fact that's necessary for the resolution of the claim. And more importantly, the consideration element, there's a benefit and detriment to both parties assigning the promissory note.
Let me just pin one thing down because it seems to be implicit in the exchange between yourself and Justice Holland. We know that the amendment to the note
basically documented what had been happening in reality all along.
Correct.
Correct? If that documentation had taken place from the beginning, that is, if the note had properly stated that the lender would be BMC and not, or the borrower would be BMC and not BCC, there would be a valid contractual obligation, correct?
BMC would have never been brought into the equation, Your Honor. We wouldn't have had to file suit against BMC because the original note would never have been amended and the obligation would have been that of BCC.
Is the answer to my question yes or no?
Your Honor, the answer is, I'm not sure if answer it in a yes or no fashion. I apologize for that.
Well, if the note had said BMC rather than BCC and there was no amendment, would that have been a proper contractual obligation?
I would submit to you, Your Honor, it would have been because not only did BMC sign it, but the performance issue would have been demonstrated also.
So
and it was BMC
yes.
who's the one who defaulted on the note.
That
the
would
one.
Be a yes?
Yes, Your Honor, yes. Okay. So passing the consideration material issue of fact, there was a separate independent legal basis that the court found.
I think the next question is, if that's the case, and this was basically ratifying, you know, documenting and in effect ratifying what had been the course of conduct all along, why does it matter? Why does any of this analysis matter at the time the amendment took place?
Because the analysis comes into effect when they assert in their defense, Your Honor, that there was a material issue of fact as to who provided consideration or who asked for the amendment, and therefore whether there was consideration. But I submit that the record was replete with evidence that both parties suffered a detriment and a benefit in this, and therefore there was consideration. But then if we advance to the next basis...
Before we do that, just help us understand. If someone's paying interest on $1 million, and at some point in time they receive the $1 million.
Correct, Your Honor. The books and records were reflected to indicate that that $1 million obligation was BMC's after the amendment was made.
All right, so at the very beginning, Mr. Salt sends in his money, and then Mr. Pincus decides what he's going to do with the $1 million. Who got the $1 million? There's something in the record that Mr. Pincus used part of it and then part of it went to...
He used it as a personal investment in another company that he started. It was BMF, Brantley Mezzanine Financing, which went bust and took the money went down. You know, there was nothing there, but he still owed the note to...
My question to you is, why does Brantley Management want to repay the $1 million? Did Brantley Management get the $1 million that it's obligated to repay?
Yes, it did, Your Honor, because it was trued up on the paperwork, and that money went to Brantley Management, and that was used by Mr. Pincus as his personal investment in Brantley Management.
It was distributed to Mr. Pincus?
Correct, Your Honor, it was. And there was tax documentation to support that, and when that $1 million dissipated when the investment failed, he took a tax deduction. He wrote that money off, so he always had the money.
I understand. I'm just trying to... Yeah. Visualize the paper trail.
Okay.
Just in put aside the electronic age.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming Mr. Salts writes a check to this investment company. And the investment company writes a check or does an electronic transfer, and we would see that the $1 million went into Brantley Management. Would we?
Well, the $1 million was wired to Brantley Mezzanine Finance and those documents, and then it was taken into the Brantley Management Company, and then Mr. Pincus used that as his personal investment.
So did Brantley Capital ever get the $1 million?
Your Honor, it shows that it went to Brantley Management, the BMC, where the money went. And there's the documentation may be somewhat convoluted, but at the end of the day, it was Mr. Pincus's company, BMC, who had the $1 million, invested it, and lost it, and there was documentation where originally it was on BCC's books as a $1 million obligation. It was eventually transferred to BMC's books and records. And when the investment failed, Mr. Pincus took that as a personal loss from his personal loss in BMC. So he's the one who received the benefit in terms of the tax ramifications. So if I may, Your Honor, there's another separate and independent legal basis for the affirmance, and that's the antecedent debt exception. As the trial court acknowledged, that was, value was given because you assumed the debt of another party. You guaranteed the debt. You were going to pay the debt. And that's consistent with the exceptions to a negotiable instrument. While the promissory note we maintain is a negotiable instrument, even if it's not, the antecedent debt exception applies, and the trial court recognized that you have now assumed this debt, you have guaranteed this debt, you are now the obligor, and the documentation supports that. Now, in the papers that were submitted, we believe for the first time there's been arguments advanced that this was not a negotiable instrument, and therefore there's language of condition in the note, and because it incorporates by reference another writing. Well, if one reviews the commentary to that, that's simply, and the statute itself, simply because it incorporates by reference or refers to another writing, does not in and of itself take it out, add the language of condition and take it out so it's not a negotiable instrument. And moreover, if you look at the purpose of why they want one document, it's the rationale so the payee knows where he's getting paid from. In this instance, my client, Mr. Saltz, is the payee. He's the holder of the note. It's made payable to him, and he's in possession of it. So the antecedent debt requirement has been satisfied, and the rationale about whether or not he has to flip through documents to figure out what the terms and conditions are is not relevant because he knows he's getting paid by BMC. In fact, BMC has paid him for over 4 years now, and it was approximately $380,000. And it was clearly in payment of and satisfaction for the debt that Brantley Management acknowledged it was responsible for when it signed the promissory note.
You can come back to your argument, but before you conclude,
yes,
I want you to briefly address your view with regard to the dissolution.
Okay, Your Honor, we believe that under Section 8 Del Code 278, I believe, is that dissolution did occur, and notice was not properly provided to us, and it's impeded our ability to enforce our collection action. No supersedious bonds ever been filed in this case, so we are actively pursuing the $1.27 million judgment. We were before the Superior Court on various post-trial post-motions concerning what discovery we needed in aid of execution, and we were never told, under 280 and 281, we should have been given notice of the dissolution.
Would you agree that this is that set of events doesn't affect the judgment, but rather impacts the ability to collect the
judgment? It does, Your Honor, and I think you've acknowledged we may have to try to claw back other monies, but under 280 and 281, we should have been given notice, and if there's going to be a plan.
Okay, but it doesn't affect
the judgment. The judgment's still in effect.
The integrity of the judgment that's the subject of this appeal.
Correct, and as you acknowledge, Your Honor, it may be a collection problem, and we're actively trying to collect that. Even if getting back to the antecedent debt exception, the argument that you make that it's not language it's unconditional, it's not unconditional language. There's still exceptions to that. When you read the commentary to the UCC, simply because something does not qualify as a negotiable instrument doesn't mean it's not enforceable and under basic principles of contract law. And so even if the promissory note is not a negotiable instrument, we still have a writing, which is the contract signed by both parties. We have a breach of that contract insofar as BMC is not paid, and clearly we have damages, and we you know, my client suffered a $1.27 million loss. Now, the last argument that the appellant makes is that there was BCM never signed the amendment. That's of no moment. That's another red herring. BCM was never going to pay this money after the note was amended. They acknowledged that by their conduct. They were off the hook at that point in time because the borrower has been substituted by Mr. Pincus' other company, Brantley Management Company, BMC. But as you go forward, Your Honor, you see, you look at it from the big picture of a reality perspective. Why did they continue to pay my client if they truly thought they had no obligation to pay him? It was BMC who
You're
signed.
Saying that BMC, from the moment it got was formally became involved as a party, that is, as a consequence of the amendment, never had any intention to pay.
No, Your Honor, we look at it. What do we have?
I'm sorry. Is there?
I believe that the record reflects that, Your Honor, because BCC never made a payment post amendment. BMC made the payments, and when the maturity date came and there was attempts to renegotiate.
I'm sorry. I thought your argument was that BMC never had any intention.
No. When
it's BCC.
BCC, right? Correct. BCC was removed from the equation, Your Honor, when the July amendment was made, and that's reflected that BCM never requested that the note be extended was BMC. BMC tried to renegotiate the terms, not BCC, and BMC is the one who's the fault, and BMC is the one here saying that they have no obligation to pay. So in conclusion, Your Honor, there is no material issue of fact here. There's proper consideration. The antecedent debt exception clearly allows my client to recover. It's definitely agreeing to pay the debt of another. Lastly, the waiver issue, the conduct of the parties is such that BMC always paid this. And with that in mind, I respectfully request that the trial court's order be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, again, there's no record, there's no evidence on the record anywhere that there was a release of Brantley Capital Management, BCM.
So you're saying that Mr. Saltz sued the wrong party?
I'm saying that Mr. Saltz should have sued Brantley Capital Management, yes.
Let me ask you this, and I think we've already covered this ground with opposing counsel. It appears not to be disputed that the amendment, insofar as it purported to substitute Brantley Management as the obligor, simply ratified the course of conduct, the reality that had occurred from the beginning of this transaction up until the amendment. Is that correct?
Not entirely correct. Somewhat correct. It is true. Brantley Management paid some of the payments when Brantley Capital was the obligor under the note. The issue, though, is when
Tell me what isn't accurate about that.
Because Brantley Capital did make some payments.
Did make some payments?
Yeah, they did make some payments. Brantley Management didn't make all of the payments. Brantley Capital made some of the payments. But when Brantley Capital came under investigation, along with Brantley Capital Corporation, with the Securities and Exchange Commission, Brantley Capital Corporation could no longer afford to make payments to Brantley Capital Management for advisory services. Brantley Capital Management then, therefore, had no revenue stream to make any payments. And out of friendship, Mr. Pincus, who controlled Brantley Management Company, a different company, started making payments out of Brantley Management Company to Mr. Saltz. Had nothing happened,
there were payments that were made by Brantley Capital.
Brantley Capital Management made some payments under the note, yes.
No, I'm talking about Brantley Capital.
Brantley Capital Corporation never made any payments under the
note. Right.
Brantley Capital Management is the original obligor.
Made payments from the beginning.
And
the amendment basically documented what had been the reality on the ground all along.
No. The note was between Brantley Capital Management. That was the maker. Okay? And back in 2004, Brantley Capital Management was the maker. Brantley Capital made some payments.
They did make some payments. Where in the
note.
Record does that reflect it?
It's not on this record.
It's not
reflected
in the record?
Discovered. Not of this record. It's reflected in discovery.
Then how can we take cognizance of that?
Because it's not of a material consequence. Because whether or not Brantley Management...
It may be a material consequence. Because if the course of conduct was basically that all the money that had been used, that had been paid on the note, was paid by BMC, and the amendment did nothing more than document the reality that was that had pre-existed, that may have legal significance.
Your Honor, I disagree that that has legal significance for this reason alone. Past consideration is no consideration. Whether or not Brantley Management made every single payment under the note or made four payments under the note before that purported amendment took effect.
Well, let me ask you this. If counterfactually the note reflected that the obligor would be Brantley Management as distinguished from Brantley Capital,
mm-hmm.
that would be a valid contractual obligation.
I did not understand your question, Your Honor.
Let's assume counterfactually that at the beginning, beginning, when the note was created, the original note,
right.
The obligor on the note was Brantley Management.
Yes, sir. That would be a binding obligation.
A valid contract.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. just like it would be a valid contract if I signed a note to somebody else right now versus I came in 5 years from now and agreed to take over somebody else's note or obligations without any consideration whatsoever. And I would note that the appellee does concede in the trial court in the trial court filing at A165 in the record in footnote 2 that whoever does request the note, the amendment was getting consideration. So I would note that in that is there, and that concession is on the record.
I want to ask just one question. The other side said that the whole concept in the record shows was this was an effort to true up the paperwork. Do you speak to that?
I can speak to that because that's the whole crux of the factual dispute. Mr. Saltz contends that this was all an effort for BMC to make this the books to true up the books and records. And Brantley Management contests that, no, that's not true. This was because Mr. Saltz wanted to have a viable entity serve as the obligee and to disassociate himself with the SEC investigation. That's the problem. That's why we needed a trier of fact to resolve this factual dispute.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and also take a brief recess.